So it's now sort of 8 o'clock. So time for this morning's talk, continuing the instructions on meditation. First day I was teaching how to relax the body, and then also yesterday gave a little, the day after, an overview of the importance of stillness, and yesterday doing the explaining the thousand petal lotus and how it opens up, emphasizing that all we really are doing is making being kind and being aware, and those two things are the most important to allow the meditation to develop. And just to emphasizing that again, and just because some people ask, well, in that book, the basic method of meditation, and the elaboration of that in that book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, that there we talk about stages of meditation. Stages of meditation are okay because that speaks the language which you are used to. But a long time ago, I sort of named them, they're stages of letting go. Not stages of attainment, but the more you let go, these are the landmarks which you see as things start to vanish, start to disappear as you go deeper inside of what's happening. And just to emphasize that, starting off with, you know, the breath, when that comes up, quite honestly, that I never go looking for my breath. The breath usually comes to me. I just relax, as I am told you, that's how I practice, until the point comes the body is relaxed, the mind is peaceful, and then the only thing left to watch is the breathing. And there is a distinction there, because if you go looking for the breath, as soon as you notice the breath, it's actually uncomfortable. It's not a natural breath. You interfere with it. It's the nature of human beings that what we observe, we tend to interfere with. And this is the same when we watch the breath. It's a little bit unnatural, first of all. So, okay, that's not such a hindrance, but see if you can like relax it so it becomes a natural breath, soft and peaceful, not hard. But the most important thing here is that if you go onto the breath too quickly in your meditation, you find you cannot maintain your awareness on the breath. It's just you're not ready for it. And even in Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha said so much preparation needs to be done before you start watching your breath. And of course, preparation is important with everything we do. If you don't wash the vegetables before you cook them, then there are going to be all sorts of bugs on the surface. So if you don't prepare, you know, the mind before you watch the breath, you'll find, yeah, you can sort of watch the breath, but only with force, and then you wander off. Or if you do really put some force in the meditation, you watch the breath, you get headaches. You get tense because you're holding the breath, you know, with too much effort. So instead of that, we learn just how to be with the breath. Now, why does the breath disappear from you? First, similarly this morning, that when you go back, you have a free afternoon and you receive a call on your iPhone. It's an acquaintance of yours. Are you free this afternoon? Said yes. Oh, great. Come and have a cup of coffee. And we're going to go to my coffee shop because I like that coffee shop. I know you don't really like it, but you're going to my coffee shop because you're free this afternoon. And we're going to have a latte. I know you like flat whites, but I like latte, so that's what you're going to have. And a chocolate chip muffin, not a biscuit, which you want. We're going to sit in the front because I like to be out on the street. And we're going to talk about politics. None of this stupid spirituality business, which is not really important in this world. The really important stuff, politics. And I've got about an hour, so we're going to sit there for an hour, okay? Now, if someone invites you for a cup of coffee, you've already accepted, and they tell you where you're going to go, what you're going to drink, what you're going to eat, where you're going to sit, what you're going to talk about, and for how long, what would your response be? You think, oh my God, what have I got myself into? I've got to get out of this somehow. Oh yeah, yes, I just remembered I do really have to go to the dentist this afternoon. I forgot about that. Maybe next time. Any excuse to get out. And so, as soon as you keep your precepts, as soon as she hangs up, you ring up your dentist, make an appointment, keep your precepts. And then straight afterwards, you receive another call from another friend. He said, how are you feeling this afternoon? He said, just made an appointment with my dentist. Oh, that's a shame, because you've always been telling me about this coffee shop you really like, you know, where the what was it? I said short blacks or long creams, I don't know. They're so delicious. I've never had those before, but you say so much about them, so I want to try one. And you said those biscuits are just so amazing, so I'd like to try one of those as well. And I always like sitting in the front, but you said round the back is really nice. So let's sit round the back. And you always wanted to talk to me about your spirituality, about your Buddhism. You know, even though I'm a Catholic, I'm interested. And so what do you do when somebody wants to go in your coffee shop, try your coffee, what you like to eat, where you like to sit and talk about what interests you? What would you do? So they said, I'm cancelling the dentist appointment. I'll see you there in 10 minutes. And when you go there, you find yourself spending all afternoon there, 3 or 4 hours, and you get late back home. Why? Because you're sitting with a friend who's kind to you, who doesn't tell you what to do, what to eat, for how long, where to sit. So what does that mean with meditation? Sometimes you tell your body and mind, right, no more sitting on the chairs, you sit on the floor. And not at the front, at the back, cause that's where I like you to sit. We're going to sit here for 1 hour. You're not going to just watch what you want to watch. You're going to watch the breath. Go in, go out. Just like telling you what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, where you're going to sit, for how long. In fact, 1 hour. Not 55 minutes, not an hour and 5 minutes. 1 hour, you sit there. It's called control freak. No wonder your mind, oh, not her again. You know, telling me to sit down. What's my bloody breath? I'm not going to do this for her. And then, of course, it runs away. You've got a bad relationship with your body and mind. So what do? You tell your body and mind, hey, body, what do you want to do? Yeah. You know, all these people sitting on chairs, they look really comfortable over there, those chairs. Well, let's give it a go. So, yeah, let's give it a try. And don't do breath meditation. Let's try this beautiful Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Now's the most important time. Whatever it is in front of you, whatever you're aware of, whatever it is, it's the most important. Don't try and get rid of it. Don't demean it, diminish it, stigmatize it, just because it's sleepiness. You know, that's not against the precepts. Let it be here. And be kind. So let's try that. Yeah, let's try that. And if your mind wants to do that, and you know that you sit there and it's, you know, you're supposed to sit for 50 minutes or an hour, you end up sitting here all morning and missing your lunch. Because you're with a good friend instead of a control freak. That is why it's hard to get into this meditation retreat. Why there's always waiting lists. Why you've got to be really fast to get in here. Simply because, you know, you're in a place of kindness and gentleness and acceptance, which means that people want to be here. So when you're meditating, do you want to be here? If you do, you're at peace. And how do you want to be here? Whatever your mind wants to do, you work with your mind, you work with your body. It's really amazing how people's relationship with their body, always trying to change it, cure it, get rid of it, move it, improve it. Your body is good enough, so care for it. Your mind always want to still it, make it wise, do all sorts of stuff with it, instead of actually being a good friend to your mind. If you're with a good friend, you just hang out together. And you relax because you're not trying to prove anything. Which means if you have that attitude towards your body and your mind, really good friend, that means peace comes very easily. And you can be with your breath. So, breath goes in, goes short. I don't care. You make up your own mind, breath. Whatever you want to do, I'm with you. So I have this wonderful attitude towards my breath. It's like a friend. It's like I hold its hand. It's like I have a teddy bear and I cuddle my breath. There you go, breath. Which means that it's easy to stay with the breath when you have a nice attitude towards it. Goes in, goes out. Isn't that beautiful, just with a nice friend? Going in, going out, going, nothing to do in the whole world. Just being with your breath. Ah, oh, I can do this all day. Breathing in, breathing out. And sometimes you do it all day. Being with your breath. Nothing else to do, so let's hang out together. Now, so that's the where you get those first two stages of meditation, which you put in the book, is Anapanasati. It says sometimes breathing in, long, breathing out, long, breathing in, short, breathing out, short. That doesn't mean, okay, stage one, breathe in, long, come on, in, long, everybody. Okay, done that one. Now breathing in, short, in. Okay, done that one. Because what it means is that sometimes when you start breathing or watching your breath, sometimes just to make it interesting, for some people it's boring, just watching the breath. I mean, spend all day watching your breath, that must just really drive you insane. It doesn't, actually, quite the opposite. But to make it interesting, that's what I said the other day, we have these little buddho with the breath, or shut up with the breath, or the one I really like, there's a couple of Indonesians here, breathing in, you say mati, breathing out, pasti, mati pasti, mati pasti, which in English means, I will die, that's for sure. And that's really good fun. So you're breathing in, I will die. That's for sure. You can't argue with that. Sorry? Yeah, you can't argue with that. That's pretty sort of incontrovertible. So I will die, that's for sure. I'll die. All that really does, it just makes it a bit more interesting. But if you ever heard me teach at Nala Mala, that sometimes you say, okay, breathing in, peace. To make it really interesting. So imagine what peace is, you know, whether it's a dove or whether it's some really calm seascape or whatever. Whatever you have an idea of what peace is, breathing in peace. And you visualize it, you imagine it. You almost like paint a picture of what peace is. And you, every in-breath, bringing in peace. And you breathe out, let go. So imagine peace riding on the wind of the breath as it comes into your body. And all the toxins, the bad memories, the fears, the sicknesses, the worries, the revenge, the whatever it is, that goes out with the out-breath. Breathing in peace, energy, health, breathe out. And you make up your own little mantra there. But if you do that, you've got to really, you know, not just breathe in, peace, breathe out, let go. Because that doesn't really grab the attention. That's to make it really interesting. That's exactly why Ajahn Gandha said, breathe in, sabha. And you can feel that. Sabha. Oh, yeah. Oh, sabha. Breathe out, sabha. You've got to really get into it for it to work. So don't ever do anything half-hearted. Whatever you do, get everything you've got. So what happens then, you really get into the breath. It's beautiful. Beautiful breath, delightful breath, there it is. Of course you get the four awareness of the breath and delightful breath. Yeah, there are stages, but they happen naturally. So do you have to tick off stage one before you go to stage two or stage three? You notice, I skipped over the full awareness of the breath just now, just went straight to the sabha. the delightful breath. Because with the delightful breath, you see the whole breath anyway. You just keep doing that. So this is actually the stages of meditation. But the most important thing is just how they occur. It's not you want. Okay, tick off the box. Now I can go to stage two, stage three. Ajahn Brahm, can you please confirm I've been to stage three so I can now go on to stage four? Give it a tick. I now, so if you can take off your P plates, now you've got L plates, now you've got X plates, now you've got X plates. I don't know what the plates you have on cars these days because I don't drive, thank goodness. But sometimes that people always like instructions. And it reminds me that some people have got too much faith in monks and nuns. So whatever they say, they just do it without thinking. Because this actually happened, really happened. This was in England. They told me the story. I checked it out. Yes, it did occur. A nun in our monasteries in England. She was going to the airport, and she had the map. So she told the driver, straight ahead at the roundabout. And that's what she did. She went right over the circle. That's what you told me to do, go straight ahead of the roundabout.
So you've got to be very careful these days. Get very prohibitive. You've got to be very, give instructions, give them very clearly.
So anyway, so you feel this is going the right direction and you get sort of the nice awareness of the breath, but then the delightful breath, the beautiful breath. And again, this happens naturally. You know, you're sitting there and you're happy meditating. You enjoy it. And I don't know what it is. But, you know, too many people, if you're enjoying yourself, you get attached. Don't get attached. And that is so crazy to me. And it's also directly against the recorded teachings of the Buddha. And this is one of the things, if you don't believe me, the books have got suttas out there in the office and get it out for you. The Buddha said, specifically, anyone who indulges in the happiness of meditation, really gets into it, there's only four possible consequences for you. The only things which can happen if you get attached to the pleasures of the deep meditation. The first stage of enlightenment, the second stage of enlightenment, the third stage of enlightenment, or the fourth stage of enlightenment. That's what's supposed to happen. This is a happy path. It's a beautiful path. That's why I really got into this. It's amazing. So profound, so deep, so much insight, and a lot of joy at the same time, a lot of happiness. So, you get into these delightful breaths. And then, what I wanted to focus on today is what happens next. So, watching the breath, oh, so nice, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Oh, one thing I wanted to just mention beforehand was that sometimes there are distractions. You're about to go into jhana and somebody coughs. Or that somebody bangs the door. Or something happens. There's distractions. How to deal with distractions. Now this is a simile which I get from when I was in the aircraft and you had to watch the safety demonstration on the little screen in front of you, on the back of the other seat. And many of you have done that. Next time, those of you who come from overseas or interstate, and you're going on an aircraft, you know, you watch that safety demonstration on that little screen, and you will notice that after a few seconds, you can't see the upholstery surrounding the screen, nor even the little plastic border surrounding the screen. But your mind, your field of attention fits perfectly into that little screen, so you can't see the edges. It's as if you focus in. And it's a wonderful thing to notice because it means you don't need to spend all your money purchasing these enormous TV screens which people have. It's totally just a con. The only time you know or you notice you're aware of how big your TV screen is when it's not turned on. When it's turned on, you're watching a movie or a football match or whatever you're watching. Hopefully it's a recorded video of your favourite monk. But whatever you're watching, you will find your mind, vision, actually just fits just into the screen and how big or how small it is. And people haven't taken me up on this yet, but how about if you want to start a new business having circular TV screens? Why do they always have to be, you know, square, rectangular? Or you may have like Star of David TV screens. They really do well in Israel. Whatever it is, something which is just different. Because whatever shape your TV screen is, big or small, round, oval or whatever, after a while, your mind fits into precisely into the screen. So, what's that got to do with meditation? What it is if you're watching your breathing or a delightful breath or whatever it is, always keep that in the center of your screen. If there's a sound, a disturbance, whatever, even an ache, if at all possible, keep that on the edge of the screen. Don't put it in the center. Because if you've got an ache or an itch, if that comes to the center of the screen, the breath goes to the edge of the screen. And soon the breath falls off and you've just got this problem in front of you. But if you keep your main meditation object in the center of your screen, you sort of hear that sound, but it's over there somewhere. Yeah, you can feel that itch, but it's over there somewhere. It's not in the center. And if it's not centered in the screen of your attention, if it's not centered, after a little while, it just falls off. It disappears. You're not aware of it anymore. That's actually what happens. You may have an itch, an ache, or that story I said about the mosquitoes. When I was in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, I made sure that, you know, the breath was in the center of my screen. And the mosquitoes, you could feel them, but they were on the edge of my screen. I wasn't paying too much attention to them. I wasn't giving them importance to bring them into the center. So they were on the edge. And after a while, they fell off. I was not aware of them anymore. And my radar zoomed in just to the breath, and the rest fell off that radar. That's how to deal with distractions. Don't center on them. Don't give them importance. Don't make them the most important part of the meditation. Just keep it on the breath. That's right here. That's in front of you. That's the most important. And it stays there. Now that's really crucial because the reason why I brought it up was that you get to the next point in your meditation when the breath starts to disappear. And for many people, they get afraid. As many times you come across fear in the meditation just because you don't know what's going on. This is weird. And so often people come up to me, interviews, and say, this weird stuff happened. Is this okay? I say, of course it's okay. But this was strange. Yeah, it's okay. I've been meditating a long time. This is what happens. Weird stuff happens. When weird stuff happens, it's marvelous. When you're meditating a long time, you don't watch movies, it's great to have some interesting stuff in your meditation. So, you know, sometimes you're sitting there, and one of the things which sometimes comes up is that your body is like crawling with ants. Just so sensitive. Sometimes you're sitting here, and you can feel this fragrant, like sandalwood essence wafting past you. You say, wow. Heavenly beings have come to visit me. Or you think, well, my goodness, it's not unpleasant, so the ants crawling all over your skin. It's quite sort of interesting. But it's not that you've got some sort of psoriasis about to happen. All it is as you become quieter and calmer, your awareness gets enhanced. So, you know, the feelings in the skin become really sensitive. Not unpleasantly, but beautifully sensitive. fragrances, smells, you interpret it just as if it's the most beautiful scents and fragrances just wafting there. It's not heavenly beings come to visit you, it's your senses are coming really, really sharp. And even sounds, beautiful sounds. All that is just the senses are getting stronger. And usually, they usually disappear soon after that. And when they disappear, don't be worried, it's marvelous. I say that because, there was one fellow a long time ago. He was a businessman in Singapore, and as soon as he started meditating properly, his hands started to vanish. He couldn't feel his hands anymore, and he came up to me, he stopped meditating straight away. He said, I'm terrified. What's going on? Is this some sort of disease where I lose all my sensations? I said, come on, can you feel your hands now? Yeah, now, but it's only because I stopped meditating. It comes back again. Just let it go and enjoy it. But when you know, you've heard, hopefully from someone you trust, what happens in meditation, then I give you the instructions so you know, that's what it is, so you don't get afraid. And as you go deeper, it's much more happiness and fun. So you know this is going in the right direction. You know it feels really good. And afterwards, you only have positive things come out of it afterwards. So you no need to be afraid, but fear will come out. Just remember, okay, no fear, it's okay. So then what happens is you get the breath starts to disappear. You're perfectly okay. You are breathing. It's just your mindfulness is just watching something a bit more interesting. Right now, can you feel your heartbeat? Most of you couldn't for the last half an hour, but you don't have to worry about it. Your heart has still been beating. Just because you're not aware of it doesn't mean it's stopped. That's all that's happening. Your breath is just... your awareness has become much more refined. So what it usually sees then is this delight of the mind, the sixth sense. Once the five senses start to get very weak, the sixth sense, the mind, starts to become strong. The energy goes into that instead of the five senses. Now usually the really big nimittas, this is when you can really see the citta, the mind, happens when the five senses are really, really subdued. But then people say, I saw a light, but I could still hear things and feel things. Yes, but whatever those five senses were pretty weak. So the explanation of that, these are the five senses, this is the mind. The five senses are usually get all your attention, all your energy, so they are so strong that they dominate. You can hardly experience the mind. But as you meditate, in other words, you're not speaking very much, you're just only eating a couple of meals, you taste, for most of the day you're not tasting anything, eyes are closed, you're not hearing too many sounds, it's a peaceful place, you are subduing your five senses here. Not getting excited by movies and stuff. Everything is getting subdued. So as the five senses don't receive your energy, that energy goes into the sixth sense of mind, and what is usually so dominant, your five senses start to be reduced in importance, in strength. The mind gets stronger until it starts to be about the same strength. And that's when you start to see lights, nimittas in the mind. You start to be aware of your mind. And once that starts happening, you see little lights, sometimes flashes of lights, and sometimes weak screen nimittas, just the whole area is like not very bright, but there it is. And at that time, don't think, this cannot be a nimitta, it can't be that stage of the meditation, because I can still hear a few things. I can still feel my body, I can still think. Doesn't matter about that. Just keep the nimitta in the center, whatever it is, however it is, and just see what happens. You do nothing, you just be kind, be aware, and see what happens next. So that means what's happening with the lotus simile, the lotus petal is opening up. The tiny little nimitta, a bit shy at first, is just opening. And when it opens up, I don't know why it is, a lot of times people, they doubt. They think, this can't be a nimitta, it can't be a nimitta. It must be a flashlight in my face. There are no flashlights here. It must be the sun shining. Unless it's a certain time of the day, sometimes over there or in the afternoon, a lot of time there's no lights coming in here. I really, I know these lights, that was a compromise with the architect. He said, you have to have some lights. And I said, why? Cinemas don't have lights. Dance clubs don't have lights. They have artificial lights, but he insisted. So we've still got some lights up there. But it's high up. You know, if you're meditating down here, they're not shining into you. And if you have any doubts at all, you get the eye shades. Put them on. So sometimes people say, oh, no, I couldn't have been an imitator. Get the eye shade on. And then you can still see that light. So it must be nimittas, mind-made. So this is the start of the nimittas. Interesting stuff. The breath has just vanished. Sometimes, you know, the petal has opened up, but not fully yet. You know, it's half open. Just see what happens next. Don't force it. If a nimitta happens, it happens. If it doesn't, you go back to the delightful breath. That's good enough. A little by little, you start to see these beautiful lights. When they do, don't say, oh, I can't be attached to these. I've got to get rid of these, or I have to get them. No, don't mess around like that. Just be kind. Be aware, that's all. So don't sort of start striving again, especially at that stage. Whatever happens, sometimes if you've got still a very active mind, those nimittas become active. It's like seeing a video in front of you. But, or a beautiful scenery. It doesn't matter sometimes that, again, you can have a nice little adventure, you know, in that stage of meditation. You know, imagine yourself flying through the air or sinking into the ground. Oh, it's really common. I don't know why this happens. Sometimes people feel they're ballooning out. Oh, they're rising up into the air. Or all sorts of weird things are happening. They're not really happening. Sometimes people feel they're swaying backwards and forwards, and they're not. Let it happen. It's good fun. It's free entertainment which doesn't break your precepts. Okay. This one nimitta I had, really good fun. You were just there, and you're imagining there was this other, a rishi. And we were doing this psychic battle, you know, in these nimittas. Zap, 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 zap. Really interesting, good fun. But that only lasts about 5 or 10 minutes, and it sort of, your mind settles down. Or, it's not fantasies. It's much more real than that. But whatever it is, just let it happen. Or one time, for those of you who are really scared, a slight bit of fear, and that's what you watch. But, you know, you can overcome that fear. Because one day, meditating, and it's really peaceful, and the breath disappeared, and the nimitta which I got right in front of me was a monster. Big, bulgy eyes, you know, red on the outside, almost like coming out of its sockets. Really angry. And its mouth was not ordinary teeth, was fangs dripping blood, and around its neck were sort of a necklace of small shrunken skulls, and as tongue was coming out, it was going and I recognized it. You know, that's because I've been to some temple sort of a couple of days before, just like you see on the temple drawings or the paintings. Oh, it had spiky hair as well. So what did I do? I'm not going to be afraid of monsters. So what I did, straight away, just like being a naughty kid at school, you know, doodling. Do you ever doodle on little drawings? So straight away, I doodled. I just thought, let's put a hat on its spiky hair. I had this lovely straw hat, of course, with a little flower coming out. And its eyes were pretty scary, so I put a pair of sunglasses on, like the Ray-Bans they had in those days. Like, so it was like the Elvis Presley of monsters. And then in its mouth, because of these fangs, I actually blacked out a couple of its teeth, so it like, looked like it needed to go to the dentist urgently, and a cigarette in the end. And I forget what else I did. Oh, actually, I turned up the corners of its mouth, so it was turning up like it was smiling. And I made this monster look so ridiculous. I totally humiliated that monster. And so it disappeared and never came back. That's how to deal with monsters. If you don't let them into the your palace, just put a funny hat on them. Put glasses on them. Or even better, like a monocle. You know, just like those old lords in England. But that's how to, I played around with it. And then it vanished. So you have all sorts of interesting limiters, which come up first of all. But that is a sign that your mind is still pretty sort of active. So just relax, calm it down. And then the limiters aren't so active. And they can be all sorts of different colors. The colors aren't really important. One time that one limiter, which was really important, and other people can probably relate to this, sometimes it was like a scenery. Sometimes people, or this time was like rolling hills and little river and trees. And very pleasant, but very complicated. So I don't know where I got these ideas from, but then my goodness, they work. That I was attracted to one leaf which had a little dewdrop on the edge, which was sparkling. And so just I allowed my mind just to go to a little twinkle on the edge of the leaf on the tree. And of course, you focus in on it, zoom in on it, just quite naturally. And of course, the twinkle gets bigger and bigger. That became just a real beautiful nimitz, the simple, powerful lights. So if you have got a complicated nimitter, you don't need to do this, because I've told you now, put the suggestion into your mind, brainwashed, conditioned. So what you would do, you go to anything which twinkles, which sparkles, and you go into it, and it becomes this beautiful, very pure nimitter. Now, you know it's a nimitter at this particular stage. There's a couple of things, that it's a light, but you're not seeing it with your eyes. It can get extremely bright, but don't be afraid. This happened to me and happened to a few other people. It doesn't happen to people anymore because they listen and they know what to do. I thought it was so bright, I'm going to go blind. Because it was like looking at the sun. But you're not looking at it with your eyes. This is a mind object. So you just let it be. You never go blind. And the other one, which is more interesting, it's more fun, is that sometimes it gets so delightful, I thought, my goodness, a human being can't take so much pleasure. A really intense pleasure. But one insight I got through experience is there's no limit to the pleasure you can experience through these limiters. I love saying things like that because people say, you're supposed to be suffering, monks. Isn't that what a monk or a nun is? It's supposed to be abstinent, having a hard time, being ascetic. That's what people think. But the truth of the matter is, why, you know, good, intelligent people, monks and nuns? Because we have access to a happiness which is way better than what you could know. And I'm introducing that to you now. So anyway, you get this incredible happiness. And the other thing is, if it's colours, the strange thing is, but it's very common, the colour which you see, yeah, you can recognise that's yellow, that's blue, or that's white, but it's not like any white you could see in this world. It's more white than white. That's the only way you could describe it. A really pure, deep blue, which is nothing like, you know, you can see in this world, but that's the only way you can describe it. And a good example of that, you know my character, you know by now. So a couple of years ago, I told all the monks about this. I was in my cave and I got one of the weirdest nimitters I've ever had. It was a nimitter again, very peaceful, breath disappearing, very happy. And then this image came up in my mind. It wasn't a monster. And it was, you know, very beautiful, very delightful. And it was yellow. And the yellows were just really incredibly deep. You know, just, you know, unworldly yellows. But the shape of it was instantly recognizable. And it was Garfield the cat. I was reading too many cartoons.
coffee in the
can. And it was true, instantly recognisable. Of course, that wrecked my meditation. I burst out laughing. I reacted, because totally unexpected. But so, anyway, you've got to be quite advanced to get the Garfield Nimitta. That's really... doesn't get you anywhere, though. But anyway, but it was a real Nimitta, because of the incredible yellows and just the precision of the lines which made it look like a cat. You know, recognizable as well. But anyway, so what you do, this is that Nimitta stage of meditation. What's happening, five senses are really disappearing, and the mind is just, the sixth sense is manifesting. But again, you know, that the more you actually stay there, and you can't do anything here, you just have to let it happen. Ajahn Chah simile, and I can never get past this one in its helpfulness and its simplicity. The Still Forest Pool. Now that was got as the name of a book, but the original simile of the Still Forest Pool, which I heard from Ajahn Chah's own mouth, was that in those days that monks would go wandering in Thailand, in the jungles, in the mountains, walking, and just staying in solitude. So you could actually walk many, many places. And you know you'd always get something to eat the next day. Maybe not much, but enough to keep you going. On arms round. But we always try to get to either a river or a lake in the evening time. Maybe mid-afternoon. Because if you're walking through the jungles, and it's hot, you get really sweaty and dirty. And I think I did about 2 or 3 days once, and I couldn't find any water, and you felt just so dirty and just so yucky, because, had nothing to wash, and also very thirsty as well. So, you find a river or a lake, you put your mosquito net umbrella, sort of maybe about 10, 15, 20 meters away from the edge of the water, and then you bathe, you filter some water for drinking, and maybe wash a robe, and then you sort of set up for the night. Now, it used to be common practice. I did that. And Ajahn Chah said that when he was doing his walkabout, that called it Tudong. It's actually the better word is the party word, Charika, the wandering monk. And so what he would do that, and then sometimes in the evening he'd keep his eyes open instead of closing them. Because when it came to the dusk, that's when the animals would come out to drink. And he said he would sit there in his mosquito net just watching the animals come out to play. And these were way before the time of Nature Channel or National Geographic or whatever else it is. When people can have so much fun watching the antics of animals in the wild and they don't know you're watching them. So he would sit there with his eyes open and just watch them. But they would only come out if he was perfectly still. Because the animals would be far more afraid of human beings than human beings of animals. The same with the snake we have over here. The snake is far more afraid of you than you are of a snake. How many people have been killed by snakes? Very few. How many snakes have been killed by humans? Huge numbers. So that's why that if you're very, very still, these animals come out, they don't harm you. And they just, you watch them play. It's really interesting. I never saw that when I was on the Tudunga or the Charika, but I remember in this hut in the north of Thailand, and the hot season, I put out some water for the birds, because there's hardly any water around. And it took a couple of days, and the birds found that little bowl of water, just like Bianca's put out for the snake. And, it only took a couple of days, and the birds found it, and I would watch them through a little knot hole in the wood of my hut in the afternoon. It was fascinating, great enjoyment, because I would never expect this. This was in the north of Thailand, in the mountains, Medang district, north of Chiang Mai. And there, after a few days, the birds, all different sizes and species, formed a queue. First come, first in. And they would queue up in a line. And it was just so cute. I'd never seen this in my life before. Big ones, small ones, all different species. And then the one would go in there, you know, you've seen the birds, they wash, they flap around, drink a little bit, and just will do what they need to do, cool off, and then they fly away. And the next one would get in. All orderly and cute. But you'd wait long enough, and there'd be a bird who would just jump the queue. And all the other birds would get out of queue. They'd peck and beat up that sort of queue jumper until that queue jumper flew away. And then it was just so amazingly joyful to see them all go back in line again. All resume their place in the queue as they were before. And then this was wilderness area, jungle, very close to the Burmese border. I've never seen this before. Even the birds knew how to organize themselves. So anyway, this is what Ajahn Chah used to do. He would actually watch them come out and play. But if they knew he was watching, then they would disappear. They would just go back into the bush. Even though they were hungry, the fear was too much for them. He said that was his simile for nimittas. You've got to sit very peaceful. If a nimitta comes out, it's like an animal coming out of the bushes to play by the still forest pool, your mind. But if you go, wow, what's that? Ah, frightened. They know. And the nimittas will run away again. So those of you who have flashing nimittas and then they run away again, that's what's happened. They come out to see and they know you're watching. So they go away again. You're not still enough. So you've got to learn how to sit there. And when the nimittas come, you just don't move. You don't say anything. You don't note. You just sit there like a statue. And see what happens. And then they'll linger around. Anyone there? And then when they realize there's no one there, or they think there's no one there, they'll come out and play. And you watch these incredible, beautiful nimittas playing by the still forest pool of your mind. And Ajahn Chah would continue on. This was a brilliant part of his simile. He said sometimes after the ordinary animals would come and play with their cubs, mess around, then when they sort of had their time in the pool, then these animals would come out. He said he never was told that such incredibly beautiful, rare animals existed. Very few people had seen them. Because they were so shy. When they came out, if he even moved, they would know. And they'd run away again. So those were the jhanas. Coming out to play by the still forest pool of your mind. Brilliant, amazing. But you had to be that quiet, that still. Don't move. Well, this is it. Oh, I've blown it again. And that is a beautiful simile which summarizes Sutta number 128 of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Upakalesa Sutta, a whole discourse of the Buddha about how to overcome the obstacles to the nimittas. And once those nimittas start to get very strong and stable, that is just the, what is it called, 9th, 10th, 11th stage of the Vanapanasati. You experience the jitta, the mind, that's the nimitta. It's Prabhasara, you see it, brilliant, beautiful, radiant. And that you calm them, actually you brighten up the nimitta first of all, give it a bit more energy, oomph, that's Sampasadanang Chitang, and then you still the nimitta. So it doesn't move, because you're not moving. And, okay, a personal anecdote. You know, for me it's easy to, it was eventually you get those nimittas coming up, you know, regularly, but they were always moving. They could never be still enough to take you into jhanas. And I was wondering, what's going on here? And it was so difficult. And a very simple little insight, because that was the area you were sort of investigating. Why is my nimitta always shaking, moving around, never stable enough to really develop? And the insight was, one morning, I was shaving my face in the mirror, in my room up in Bodhinyana, shaving it there, and I noticed my face was moving in the mirror. And I thought, you know, just playing around, I thought, I'll hold the mirror still. So I held the mirror still, but still the image kept on moving because the one which was watching was moving. And it's a simple thing like that just gave me the answer to my problem. The limiter was moving because I was moving. And trying to hold it still, that's just like holding a mirror still. That's not going to get you anywhere. No, just imagining somebody being the watcher, that's going to be still. When that became still, the limiter became still. Because the limiter is just a reflection of your mind, reflection of your jitta. And if you are still, limiter becomes still. And then you enter those jhanas. So it's like the limiter, you fall into it, or envelops you, it's just the same experience. And you go into the jhana lands. Now somebody asked the question, can you explain them a little bit about the realm of experiences in jhanas? Yeah, you can explain them, but they don't really make any sense to you. Simply because it's very different than the world which you experience now. Pure bliss, pure love, but there are little signs, tick boxes if you like. If you think, is this a nimitta? It can't be. Because you can't think. You can't sort of judge. You can't create concepts within the nimitta realm. You're too still for that. Even in the nimitta stages, sorry, in this inner jhana stage, it's far more refined. But in the nimitta stages, if you say anything, wow, this is interesting, of course, the animals vanish. They know you're watching. So in the jhana stage, you're totally without thought. Yes, afterwards, when you come out, you can look at that, very powerful experiences, and understand what they were. But within them, it's too simple, too still, but very blissful. So number one, no, you can't create any thoughts there. Number two, you can't feel the body or hear sounds. You are way beyond that. Five senses have shut down. So if somebody touches you on the shoulder, come on, it's time for lunch, you cannot feel it. Hot, cold, mosquitoes, whatever, you can't know it. The gong goes, you're just sitting there. A nice little story, anecdote. There was in Wat Pa Phong once this little novice, maybe about 9, 10, 11 years of age, because, you know, in those days that was the social safety net. Too many kids in the family couldn't support them, they'd make them be a novice. And so they get looked after. Usually when they get about 15, 16, 17, they just disrobe and just go out and get a nice life. Not a nice life as a monk, but you know, just an ordinary life. They get a good education, a good moral background, and go to universities and just make something of their lives. And so this little novice was there, and Ajahn Chah was giving this talk, and he was going on and on and on, and on and on and on, starting at 7 p.m., 8 p.m., 9 p.m., 10 p.m., and it wasn't always really amazing Dhamma. It was, you know, I was there at the time. Sometimes it was just really rubbish. And I say that with greatest respect to my teacher, because every now and again, just like, you know, when you're digging in the ground, mining, then you find a diamond or you find a bit of gold or something. It was worth it. Just for that, you know, one little nugget of gold with about 3 hours of rubbish. But with this little novice, you know, he was getting really tired. He said, look, I'm only a little fellow. It's okay for these monks. I'm only here because I've got no choice. These monks decided to become a monk. I want some sleep. I want to go back to my room. I want to... And he was just really getting negative. And then he started thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he 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 going to stop? Apparently, the kids these days say, "When are we there yet, Mum? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?" And so, this is what he was saying, is, when is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is it going to stop? When, and it became like just a repeated announcement without any end. And then he had the insight. The insight is just seeing things the other way around. And his insight was, when am I going to stop? And his little novice stopped. So that's how, what he told us afterwards, what happened. You know, he's thinking, when am I going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? And then he thought, when am I going to stop? And he stopped. Because when he opened his eyes, it was early in the morning. Oh, well, the sun was up. The monks had gone off for alms round. And he'd been sitting there for hours. He hadn't heard, you know, the ring of the bell, the chanting, or the monks get up and go to bed. And he was just sitting there, the happy little novice, first time in a jhana. And he, that's what happens, you don't hear anybody. You just sit there, perfectly happy. So he stopped. That's what it is. So when it is a jhana, you don't hear anything, you don't feel anything in your body, but my goodness, you're having a wonderful time inside. Really blissed out, happy time with no meaning anymore. So that's what happens in the jhana. Beautiful, wonderful state to be in. And then you say, well, so what? A nice time, yeah, but so what? Number one, health problems, they get zapped. So I'm not quite sure why this is. But it seems to be, because I've seen this too many times, that anyone who really does get into a jhana, woo, it's amazing just how the body just balances itself and you get incredibly healthy afterwards. Number two is really strong mindfulness afterwards. And, you know, one of the great signs is that, you know, somebody calls you, you stupid person. You're just smiling there, as happy as a Larry, you don't care. That's why sometimes, you know, okay, sometimes I use skillful means. You know, somebody comes along and they say to me, sort of, you know, they've got a jar. I'm not really sure whether it was or not, and I look at them and say, look, you know, you're a lay person. You know, you're not really even a Buddhist. You haven't given any dana. People like you can't get jhanas. And I just look at them, see how they react. I say, what are you talking about? That's discrimination. I say, okay, that wasn't a jhana, sorry. It's only a trick. You know, sometimes you're not really, I'm not really good at offending people. I try my best sometimes. I need some more lessons. But what you do is, you know, just try and poke them a little bit to see if they react. And if they react, oh, that wasn't a jhana. If it's a jhana, it's just so peaceful, just floating on air. And the nearest thing which I can describe it as is just, I don't know if you, well, you probably don't remember yourself because, you know, it's just too close to you, but if you've ever had sort of like a good friend or maybe a sort of a daughter and they've just fallen in love, and say, Mummy, oh Mummy, I've just met the most beautiful guy. He's wonderful. Oh, he's lovely. I'm in love. Is that convincing? Probably not. But you know, you see that, it's just crazy sweet and nothing could upset you. He doesn't know you're high and people say, you know, they wouldn't love a person like you. He said, oh, but he does. But what about your homework? Oh, who cares about homework? Where are you going to live? Oh, who cares? Love will conquer all. You're totally beyond criticism, upset, anger, or anything. And that's the closest, you know, which I can say is when people get the jhanas. Oh, I don't know. I have my jhana. Oh, so lovely. Oh. That's really quite sweet and cute when that happens. You know, because they're just really happy, very high. Nothing can upset them. The five hindrances are gone for a while. That is where you can start to get really great insights. Oh, well, the fact, what? You mean you could actually live without thinking? Be so incredibly still? That, you know, that your body is just not there and you're having the time of your life? Yes. Why? This body is suffering. Oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm, you've been a monk too long. Get a real life. Come on. So, haven't you been to see Niagara Falls yet? Have you seen the Great Wall of China? You haven't lived, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, come on, that all sucks. You know, if you can let go of your body, now that is really impressive. There's much more happiness than anything else which you can get in this world. Totally free. Jhana tells you about what suffering is. So what the benefit of that? Number one, you're never afraid of death anymore. What are you afraid of death for? This body just gets older and sicker and more painful, more difficult to get up. You know, just more things you can eat, you can't eat. More times you have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet. Oh, that, if you haven't got there yet, that's coming. So, why? So when we realize that, so, oh, just like in the wise words of, was it George Bush? Bring it on. He was up there. He said, who said that? Bring it on. Nike. No, that's Nike is, what Nike is, just do it. Yeah, bring it on or something. Anyway, they're not afraid of stuff anymore, especially of the world. So you know, you get a huge amount of insights. But later on, say, the insights into just non-self. Did you do that? The jhanas? No, of course you didn't. That's why I asked the question. Keep on asking me. How many years of practice did you first experience jhana? How frequently do you encounter them now? And what? Okay. Honestly, I have to be open and honest with you that I cannot do jhanas. Are you shocked? Ajahn Brahm, you know, I just cannot enter jhanas. You know, so if you haven't heard this before, always, it's not just playing around with you. There's an important message here. Ajahn Brahm, I have to vanish, first of all. I disappear. No will, no me, no self, no ego. When I disappear, get out of the way, let it happen, then the jhanas occur. But I don't do them. That is important for you to understand. Because some of you had deep experiences, they could have been jhanas, but they were close, and you want them back again. I want, because they're powerful experiences, really pure and beautiful. Wow. I want, you cannot get them back. You cannot make them happen. You've got to let go, get out of the way, abandon, renounce, and then they happen. So this is an important point for those who experience jhana somehow or other, sometimes just by mistake. You didn't really intend to, but there it was. But when it does happen, you remember, oh yeah, okay, this is, I'm not there when it happens. You disappear, your mind, there's mindfulness, but there's no will, there's no control, there's no doing anything, and it just, you come out when it's ready, and then you understand. You don't achieve jhanas. That's why they're not called achievements. Stages of letting go. Stages of disappearance, the art of disappearance. Vanishing. You. Going. So that's why we don't have little medals. First jhana medal, second jhana medal, third jhana medal, fourth jhana medal. Stripes. One stripe is Sotapanna, two stripes is once returner, three stripes is non-returner, and little stars on the shoulders to show that you are fully enlightened. There's no place to pin the medals. You'll vanish. You'll disappear. So that is the jhanas. And later on, some more about the insights which come from those incredible experiences. As one person once told me, it's a really nice little, he said, you know, because delusion and our awija is so really incredibly fixed to us, we need a big kick up the arse to get rid of it. Not ordinary stuff, but this big boot. And that is what the jhanas do. Powerful stuff to dislodge defilements of the ages. So, it's coming. Wait for it, vanish. And when you disappear, then the jhanas will come. Da da da. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Hee hee hee. Okay.